I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Pennsylvania voters will have a chance to pick a new attorney general after Kathleen Kane announced that she was not seeking re-election. The office has been embroiled in controversy with Kane, who had her law license suspended, facing a criminal trial later this year. Today, we start the first of a series of one-on-one interviews with candidates for attorney general before the April 26th primary. Our guest is Joe Peters, who's running against State Senator John Rafferty for the Republican nomination. He was a police officer in Scranton, a federal prosecutor in Philadelphia, deputy state attorney general, even worked as Kane's communication director for about 9 months. Peters served as deputy drug czar in the Clinton administration and in the Department of Homeland Security in the Bush administration, and was for a while the head of the Scranton Cultural Center. And Joe Peters joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good to be here with you, Marty, and your listeners.
Absolutely. And to our listeners, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. How do you propose to bring stability, even integrity, to the office of the Attorney General?
I think a couple of things, and they can be done concurrently. I grew up in that office, Marty. I started in law school as a law clerk under the first elected Attorney General. We're fortunate in a state where, starting in 1980, the law was changed and we elect our AG now. And I served under all of the elected and most of the interim appointed Attorneys General. And so I know the office, I know the people, I know the functionality. So I think and I hear from people in that office every week. And of course, you know, many are friends, many aren't, but reaching out because they are desperate to get back on track and to have someone with integrity. And that's not – I'm not casting aspersions on anybody else. The office is under a pale. And they want someone who is a leader, who is experienced, who can on day one – begin to operate the office and not
have. How do you do that, though?
Well, I think you walk in and you number one, you set standards for conduct and integrity. We've all seen the pornographic emails, and you know, there's kind of a malaise that has just kind of overtaken the office. And I think you also acknowledge the good work that is being done. Part of this cloud places this shadow over 800 plus people, agents, lawyers, support staff, whom every day are working for the citizens of the Commonwealth, but no one hears about that. It's just about the difficulties that are occurring now. So I think you highlight those and you begin a new chapter for the office with someone who knows how it works in all of its pieces and parts.
Let me go back just a couple of years, putting yourself in Kathleen Kane's shoes, that if you had discovered these pornographic, it's even more than pornographic emails, what would you have done?
I think you immediately stop. Number one, you make it clear that this will not be tolerated, how inappropriate it is on any number of levels.
These are on government servers.
Exactly. I was going to say, not just the horrific messages and pictures, but the fact that it's being done on the taxpayer's dime. I think, secondly, you immediately implement office and diversity training. And it's something that's mandatory for every employee. I don't care if you drive the truck for the mail or you're the first deputy attorney general or the attorney general. In all of the governmental entities in which I worked, if you set that standard and you set it high and you set it higher than that required of other employees, and I think that's fair for the Office of Attorney General, and you institute mandatory training. And there are creative ways to do it now with the internet. You can do it at home, and you can sort of log on, and it ensures that you're watching, and it documents the fact that you've received this, and you take a little test to show that you get it. And this is the way it's going to be from now on.
Is this, though, some people did lose their jobs. We've got two Supreme Court justices who are essentially taken down from this scandal. Is this a fireable offense? Is it an offense that deserves being kicked out or being disciplined or being retrained?
I think it depends on the nature of the messages, the extent of them, where you sent them, where you didn't solicit them, and you, on top of it, you didn't open them. You know, that's a different person. That's a different case than the sort of the perpetrator, the creator, the disseminator of hundreds of these. So I think you need to be fair, but you need to be firm in terms of implementing whatever discipline there is going to be. And I think in some cases there should be firing, and in other cases perhaps not.
Well, it does raise questions about why prosecutors or lawyers and judges would feel comfortable enough with each other to be trading some of this email, this offensive email. I mean, what does that tell us about our judicial system?
I think what happens, and it happens in all kinds of occupations, there is this collegiality that goes too far, and this chumminess that extends beyond what should be the professional relationship. It's okay to have friends and be friends, and, you know, lawyers all the time. I spent 3 weeks, 3 months, I should say,
down the street
during
here, right?
The Scarfo trial with 17 other lawyers. There were five of us prosecutors. And when you're together for 3 months, and we even went to trial every other Saturday, and the jurors were anonymous for their own safety and locked up in a hotel for 3 months away from their families. So, you know, you go at it in the courtroom, but afterward, you know, there's kind of this friendliness that develops. And I think whether you're a nurse—
But that shouldn't include pornographic email.
No, but what happens is, and I was going to say, whether you're a nurse or a cop or whatever, you get sort of indigenous kinds of comments and jokes and camaraderie and fraternalistic things, and they go too far. And the problem with lawyers and judges— And if you look at the Supreme Court justices, many of them have been district attorneys. That's sort of the downside of electing a Supreme Court, is the fact that, you know, visible people are good candidates. And one of the most visible kinds of positions for a lawyer is to be the DA. And of course, it's that connotation of tough on crime. So you end up as a Supreme Court justice. All of your pals are still DAs and ADAs and cops. So those friendships don't end, nor should they. But what needs to be ensured is that there are certain walls and certain roles professionally separate from the personal, and neither the twain shall meet. And that, because that raises an unfairness issue for defendants. You know, if I'm communicating with the judge, is he going to or she going to rule in my favor unfairly to a defendant, a lawyer of whom is not a friend of the judge?
I do want to move on from this, but just a couple of other questions.
Please.
Only because it has really consumed the office of the Attorney General for a couple of years now. Kathleen Kane says that these scandals tell us something about an old boys network in Pennsylvania, whether it's between judges or lawyers, or lawyers or lawyers, or judges and judges. Do you think she's on to something?
I think what she's onto, however you characterize it, is the issue we're just talking about. And no one tried to have friendships over 20 years all of a sudden present a complication in our judicial system, but it's where we are.
Right.
So we need to take care of it. And I think that's what's happened. And, you know, is there an old boys network? I guess that will be determined as this unfolds. You know, her legal troubles still exist, even though she said she's not running for attorney general. There's a trial scheduled for August criminally. She's got the Senate still has its effort to remove her if need be, with the governor's cooperation. And then there's a House impeachment process, which are all kind of paused. And I think when she announced she was going to not run again.
Right.
It took down the angst a little bit. So all those things are kind of idling.
You were communications director for her for about 9 months, and you did leave shortly after she went to the Philadelphia Inquirer, took along a well-known libel lawyer, Richard Sprague. Was that a reason or the reason for you leaving, or was that just coincidence?
You know, I hate to discuss personal discussions at that level. You are correct. I was asked to be Attorney General Kane's communications director and also a senior executive deputy attorney general to be able to help with sophisticated investigations and prosecutions in the drug and other areas. You know, like all relationships, sometimes they flourish and sometimes they go in the other direction. And I think, being candid, ours was going in the other direction. It was never intended to be a permanent thing. In fact, when Attorney General Kane asked me to serve in both those capacities, it was because I had served all of her predecessors. As we mentioned, I had started with the first attorney general. And, you know, she said, you've helped all of my predecessors. I'm the least experienced coming in. She acknowledged that. And I need whatever expertise you can offer. And I said to myself and to her that it was going to be so permanent, I was not moving to Harrisburg. So I would literally drive 5 hours a day, a 2.5 hour trip in each direction from Scranton to Harrisburg, because I was not going to get embedded again in state government in Harrisburg. And here I am running to be the attorney general. Go figure.
Well, exactly.
But my departure, to more directly answer your question, was not coincidental to the instance you talk about where she walked in with Dick Sprague.
Yeah.
You know, that interview, that meeting was to be very different in terms of meeting with an editorial board in a very sophisticated collegial way and making a case for her decision, which might not have been my decision. In fact, it would not have been my decision, which got her to that point. But she's the attorney general. And I was called off the meeting and told, don't show up, because I think she knew what my reaction would be to that quickly changed plan. And back to your comment about good old boys,
mm-hmm.
What was sad was, and there was such hope for her as the first woman attorney general and an example to young women and to the first Democrat, and her assertions about good old boys network, to walk into an editorial board meeting at the Philadelphia Inquirer with the quintessential good old boy, and I don't mean it unkindly toward
Richard
his
Sprague.
Age, Richard Sprague, and to be literally at his side saying he'll speak for me, was so antithetical to that whole notion of hers of a good old boys network.
We have about a minute before our first break here. What then do you see as the number one issue facing Pennsylvania that you think an attorney general, or if you get the job, that you would like to take on?
Well, I think beyond immediate restoration of integrity and removing this cloud and moving forward, I think that the opioid heroin addiction and, dare I say, sadly, death situation, which is gripping our Commonwealth from inner city to suburbia to rural areas who can deal with it least, is truly an epidemic and a crisis for us in law enforcement and across multiple sort of areas of our life. It knows no demographic boundary. You could be the single mom in the inner city or the college kid at Penn State or the accountant in between, and it is gripping us all. And I have some thoughts about that, which we can talk about if you'd like.
Absolutely. I do want to talk about it, and I do want to take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Talking with Joe Peters in this hour of Radio Times. In fact, this is the first of a series of interviews with the candidates for attorney general here in Pennsylvania, both Republican and Democrat. Joe Peters running against State Senator John Rafferty for the Republican nomination. And April 26th is the date of the Pennsylvania primary. There's more than just presidents who will be sloshing around this state here. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking with Joe Peters. He wants to be the Attorney General of Pennsylvania. He was a police officer in Scranton, a federal prosecutor here in Philadelphia, Deputy State Attorney General. He served as Deputy Drug Czar in the Clinton administration and in the Department of Homeland Security in the Bush administration. And as I said earlier, for a while was head of the Scranton Cultural Center, Scranton, where he was born and raised and lives now. 1-888-477-9499. How do you then propose dealing with the opioid / heroin epidemic that, as you describe, is affecting really all segments of Pennsylvania?
Well, it's a complicated issue. Every time, you know, we look at this drug problem, and I've spent my whole life working on it, from street cop to state drug chief to working in two White Houses on the drug issue as a senior person in the drug czar's office. And, you know, every time we think it can't be worse, it gets worse. You know, we saw the fentanyl craze and people dying, and then we saw crack cocaine, and God, what could be worse than that? And then methamphetamine came along and gripped our population, and then, you know, terrorism drops itself in, and we sort of skew our focus toward that of necessity. And all of a sudden now, heroin is reemerging. And why? You know, heroin, nobody ever wanted to be a heroin addict. There were those people that were proponents and are of marijuana and cocaine and et cetera. But nobody wanted that stigma, that image of being in an alley with a needle in their arm. And ironically, that was helpful in keeping particularly young people and others away from heroin, because who wanted to be that? Now, ironically, we have a very different delivery system.
It starts in the medicine cabinet,
correct,
doesn't it?
You know, the biggest cohort of drugs of abuse today, believe it or not, are legitimate pharmaceuticals. Mm-hmm. We never thought we'd be saying that either. And then you have the messaging in the opposite direction from the heroin needle in your arm now to young people, which is why we really need to educate them on the front end. You know, that pill is in a medicine bottle in mommy and daddy's medicine cabinet. So that's a good thing in contrast to that needle in the arm. So we've got that challenge already on the front end. And what happens is these pills are so powerful. They are so addictive. Now, are they necessary? Sure. Do we want to get in the way of
these
a doctor-patient relationship? Sure. You know, whether it's oxycodone or Percocet or Percodan or Oxycontin, people have a right to the best care they can get, and the government has no business in their relationship with their doctor or violative of HIPAA. But everybody, including the physicians, need to be aware and need to be partners in this educational process, because what happens is you get your pills, you take them. Some people are more prone to addiction than others. All of a sudden, you're addicted. The pills are gone. So you start doctor shopping, go to another doctor claiming a backache or whatever. And then when you run out of doctors from whom you can get prescriptions, then you go and you buy them on the street, and they get very expensive at $45 a pill or whatever it is. When that dries up, you're stuck with street heroin,
which is cheap.
You can get it anywhere. And now you are a heroin addict. And then what the problem is, we can't look at it at that point as a law enforcement issue. Now, people don't expect this tough cop who's done this his whole life and prosecutor to say that, which is good because I get attention every time I say it.
But I don't think you're alone in that. I think a number of people that have been tough on drugs are saying this is more a social issue, a mental health issue, and perhaps even looking at the tough on drugs that came out of the Clinton administration, perhaps it's time to rethink that because we've incarcerated people that have a problem of addiction, but not necessarily criminals.
That's exactly the problem, the situation. We need to call it what it is. That doesn't excuse the behavior that got them there, but it recognizes that they are a health problem now. They're not a criminal justice problem. You can lock them up all day long, and as soon as they get out, they're going to be right back in because you're not dealt with the addiction. I am a proponent of, and I say this and it sends chills up people's spines, coerced treatment. Or another word for it is
mandatory.
Alternatives, mandatory, drug courts, mental health courts. You know, at the intersection of a drug issue is typically also a mental health issue, not to mention all the other societal impacts. So if you mandate treatment instead of mandating prison for the addict, you're being smart on crime, and that's just as tough as being tough on crime. I remember being around the country in the Clinton White House and establishing drug courts as creative alternatives to help people, actually, and also to help taxpayers, and I'll tell you why. And I remember people standing before the judge, and he would say, prison or drug court, prison or treatment. And so many would say, prison, Your Honor. And I would be stunned when I first heard that. But it was always the same response. Your Honor, I'd rather go to prison because treatment is too damn hard.
And it is.
But the data shows, the longitudinal studies show that coerced treatment, imposed, mandatory treatment works just as well or better than waiting for someone to bottom out. Because guess what, Marty? Symptomatic of addiction is denial. So you'll wait a long time. And if we can manage this issue. And if even if you don't care about the human side of this mom in the inner city who's single and has kids and now a heroin addict, you know, think about it from a taxpayer perspective. If we can diminish her drug taking to whatever percentage, let's say half, that means she's in the ER half the time less. She's a better mom half the time more. She's not missing work half the time. And it goes on and on and on. So we need to stand up and recognize that.
How, though, does an attorney general, whose job is to essentially carry out the laws of the Commonwealth, how does the attorney general get involved in mental health treatment?
Who better to be an activist, a proponent of innovative solutions to a very difficult problem than an attorney general? In fact, it would be attorney general malpractice if an attorney general didn't try and be a leader and use the bully pulpit and work with the legislature and gather the healthcare professionals and be that leader for this innovative, systemic and systematic approach to solving this problem. You know, like I said, the tough on crime part, going after the gangs, is almost the easy part because it's very clear, it's black and white. Treatment and healthcare are different.
Does this represent a change of point of view on your part?
No, because I think I made this epiphany when I went to the Clinton White House and when four-star General Barry McCaffrey asked me to be his deputy for law enforcement issues, but also state and local affairs, which meant I work with governors and mayors and councils and boroughs and all of those. And when you look at the data, you are quick to see that the answer lies really in the more important aspects of this problem, treatment on the back end, prevention, education on the front end. So I was an advocate, you know, for moving money around to bolster those front end and back end solutions and have been an advocate ever since.
Let me ask you a couple of other
sure.
things. You mentioned Nikki Scarfo, mm-hmm. well-known mobster here in Philadelphia, no longer out doing his nefarious activities. Does Pennsylvania have a mobster drug king problem?
Pennsylvania will always have an organized crime problem, as will New York City, as will Chicago, et cetera. It has been eclipsed for two reasons. There are more heinous issues today, i.e. the terrorist, and particularly now we can't, you know, terrorists used to be, oh, that happens in the Middle East somewhere across an ocean someplace. No. Now it's the homegrown violent extremist. It's the guy who runs up to a Philadelphia police officer sitting in a car in December and starts shooting. It's the Eric Freen in the Poconos who allegedly assassinates and kills a trooper and another trooper. And so organized crime will be there. I think the Scarfo days were the peak. And our case was based upon, you know, years of wiretapping and getting inside the mob because they weren't just criminals. They were corrupt people who corrupted others. And that's sort of part of my anti-corruption mantra. We convicted them in this three-month trial where the jury was locked up as we were talking away from their families for their own safety. They were anonymous to even the prosecutors just to keep them safe thereafter. And the trial being 4 months long with 17 defense lawyers and five prosecutors and putting this evidence on of nine murders, including a judge who allegedly took money and didn't do what he should have done, of orchestration of $1 million payment to a councilman.
Mm.
Now, where does that happen? You know, to corrupt the government so they could control a project and make money on it. They could call a strike in a union in a casino as quickly as we could snap our fingers to get what they wanted. So that case and convicting an entire mafia family and the attention that came from that around the country that this could be done. You know, the Associated Press and, you know, at the time it was kind of flattering but tongue-in-cheek too. They wrote a story that, you know, this once invincible mob was taken down, and they compared the five of us prosecutors to and called us modern day untouchables.
Mm.
And after I left, you know, and saw the companion article literally comparing us to Elliot Ness as fearless, seeking the truth, unafraid, wanting to do the right thing, I thought, you know what? That's my mantra for the rest of my life. to be that modern-day untouchable. And that's why fighting corruption is so important.
And that's Joe Peters, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He wants to be the Attorney General of Pennsylvania. And again, calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. We have a tweet from ATP. This goes back to the opioid part of our conversation here, saying, would you consider suing the opioid makers who've been aware of the prescription abuse but did nothing to slow doctor prescriptions down? That gets a little bit into the weeds there, but can we trace the problem back to the drug makers, or is it more complicated than that?
I think it's a good question from your listener, but I think it's more complicated than that. You can't, you know, if the product is faulty, that's one thing. But if the product happens to be effective because it's powerful, then there's responsibility all the way down the chain in terms of the doctor's prescription as well as the patient's, care. In taking it.
Let me ask you about a couple of other things. Governor Wolf has put a moratorium on the death penalty in Pennsylvania, wants to study it. Where do you stand on the death penalty?
I think the death penalty, sadly, is a necessary thing. I think we need a necessary form of punishment and incapacitation. Obviously, and you can't say it enough, it is the last resort.
When was the last time someone was executed in Pennsylvania?
Oh, years and years and years and years. And, you know, as it should be, because the problem is, and while I'm a proponent of keeping it on the books, where it's necessary, we have to be certain it is not implemented in a disparate way or an unfair way, racially, demographically. Overlay that with the advances in science and DNA. Mm-hmm. And every time you pick up a newspaper, it gives you the chills to read how an otherwise guilty man was now innocent because DNA proved that he didn't or she didn't do it. Now, God forbid we would have executed that person.
Which raises questions about our criminal justice system. Do defendants get the kind of defense that they need in some of these complicated, violent cases?
And those issues are always worth study. You know, I am an attorney general who will be an attorney general, who is somebody who is, yes, tough on crime, but measured in the application of punishment and invasions of privacy, and also wanting to ensure that everybody has a fair shake. You know, the fancy words are equal protection under the law and all of that, but everybody deserves a level playing field. You know, I used to do a lot of teaching of prosecutors, continuing legal education, and, you know, I talk about the tools available, grand juries and immunity and wiretapping and subpoenas. And, you know, we can invade people's lives, listen to their most personal conversations, get into the most difficult parts of their lives, and even take a life as police officers. Those are pretty onerous responsibilities, and bring with them even more responsibility to be judicious in implementing them. And I'd always close the class after revving up these prosecutors to go out and save the world by saying, however, sometimes the case that you don't bring, the subpoena that you don't issue that will unfairly besmirch a person, a family name, may be the most important case that you bring. So it's about being measured, and it's about being fair in the implementation of everything, in arrests, incarceration, punishment.
Let me ask you about Cash for Kids. This was the judicial scandal in Luzerne County. From your perspective, was that problem addressed in an effective way? Can we say that our juvenile justice system in the Commonwealth is one that people can be proud of and feel confidence in?
I think overcoming that situation allows us to begin to be proud. But, you know, how dare we ever stop looking at those kinds of circumstances or ever be satisfied, whether it's Kids for Cash, whether it's the Sandusky instance at Penn State, where, you know, $200 million was spent. And I think it's worth looking at, again, the board actions, you know, not trying to create criminals needlessly. But I think we can always learn and look back at, you know, did the trustees handle this properly? Was that money spent judiciously? Was the free report the right approach? Was there a rush to judgment or not? Were there people unfairly besmirched? Were there people not held accountable? And I think you sort of transition then to the second mile. You know, Marty, the attorney general has this, I call it the little engine that could. It's a part of the office called the Charitable Trusts and Organizations section, which oversees every non-for-profit. Second Mile's a non-for-profit. It's right. defunct now. But the Attorney General has the authority to look at the fiduciaries on that board. Were they doing their job? That was there for children. Were they protecting children? Did they realize or should they have that Sandusky was using this as a delivery mechanism for his victims? Was there proper reporting? I think we need all of this.
With the potential of charging people if all those things are true?
If, yes. That's the job of an Attorney General. Again, not calling people guilty unfairly or saying there will be or should be more arrests, but certainly looking at it, using every authority of this office. Whether it's the criminal side and investigating grand juries, which got to the problem with the diocese in Johnstown and Altoona. If you didn't have a grand jury where witnesses felt protected and their identities such and felt free to testify, or even if you had to compel their testimony to get to the truth, those are important tools that an attorney general can use. And if you have an experienced one, you can use them for criminals and to help children and the kinds of examples we're talking about.
About another minute before our second break here. I know you want a veterans advocate in the office of the Attorney General. Why? Because we have a Department of Military and Veterans Affairs.
We do. And that's not a negative comment toward Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. They've got a big job to do, including keeping us safe with the National Guard, et cetera. This was more to sort of help them and to coalesce all of the needs of our veterans and assess gaps and be more meaningful in our assistance. In the Office of Attorney General, there's one advocate. There's a little bit of magic in that word because this person, she or he, is specially empowered, almost quasi-independently of the AG, to deal on behalf of consumers as their direct advocate with the PUC and rate hikes, et cetera. I want to use that model, go to the legislature on day one, but not wait for the creation of a veterans advocate, move right out on it. Mm. You know, there's a part of the AG's office now where you can call as a veteran, you get a pamphlet, and I'm not diminishing that effort. It's something. I'm talking about an entire larger section of the office that advocates for veterans, that helps with PTSD, suicide, separation issues, family issues, predatory lending, directly with those vets and give them what they deserve, which is much more than they're getting.
That's Joe Peters, running for Attorney General here in Pennsylvania, 1-888-477-9499. Much more after this very short break. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane talking with Joe Peters. Just a recap here. He was a police officer in Scranton, a federal prosecutor, deputy state attorney general, worked in both the Clinton and Bush II administrations, and he is running for the Republican nomination for attorney general here in Pennsylvania. The primary is April 26th, and I have heard said that there's so much focus on people running for the White House that we are forgetting that there are people running in this state, across the state, for very important positions here in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. So we are going to be interviewing all the attorney general candidates, and I should add also the people running for Senate here in Pennsylvania. Let me just read a couple of comments. A tweet from Walt, he says, in the 80s and 90s, crack in the African-American communities, criminal penalties, 2016 opioid addicts, mostly white healthcare solutions. He's saying when it was black people using drugs, we went after them and put them in prison. Now that it's white people, we come up with healthcare solutions. Is he on to something?
Well, addicts don't belong in prison, and I think we've evolved as a society, and I think even in terms of minimum mandatory sentences, you know, sometimes we react, politicians react, they're hearing from their constituents, they want to pass a law to show they're doing something, they're well-intended even, let's assume, and all of a sudden you have minimum mandatories that are unfairly impacting a minority community in terms of crack cocaine. And, you know, in the Clinton White House, myself and the drug czar took on that issue and said, you know, this disparity of impact in the minority communities is something we need to fix. Good idea to have severe penalties because we want to stop people. But again, if we recognize this is a problem of addiction, we need to deal with that and not make them further criminals and clog up the criminal justice system.
A tweet from John. He says, what does Joe plan to do about the horrible status of child protective services in Pennsylvania? Do you agree with that?
I think there are some issues that need looking at. And I'm not sure specifically what your listeners to which they allude, but I've had people contact me in the area of Northeast PA, the Kids for Cash area, saying, you know, they have a new concern. And again, I don't know enough, and I'm not, you know, I hate to even say it because it may be unfair, and I don't want to do that. But it has been raised to me that similar to Kids for Cash, you know, that you know, this sort of custody for cash notion where, through federal law, again, well-intended items in legislation, that counties, every time they place a child in a foster home or an adoptive home, they get money for doing it, allegedly. Again, this is just new to me. It came to me from concerned citizens. And that, geez, you know, just like asset forfeiture, where police can sometimes focus on the money rather than the crime because right. That becomes the brass ring, that in this case, you know, if the county is making more and more money by placing children, are they too quickly jumping and denying the parents their parental right? Now, everybody wants kids in a good, safe home. But this presumption that sort of parents first, unless we can prove otherwise, you know, if it becomes about the money, like the Kids for Cash, and geez, the more children we can place, the more money we get, does it have the unintended or worse intended impact of removing children unfairly from their homes?
And you're saying that's a question mark.
Question mark. Yes, ma'am.
You're a member of the NRA.
Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am.
does Pennsylvania need to address either gun laws or registration or even have laws that people should report, for instance, stolen guns? I know that was an issue that came up a couple of years ago. I believe the legislature did not move on that. Would that be something that would make sense to you?
Well, we need to have citizens engaged all the way around. You know, you always run into murky waters when you mandate things as opposed to encourage things. And we need to do better at assimilating our gun laws. Guns are a huge issue, particularly in an urban city, urban center. And there are laws on the books now that are very powerful. In terms of minimum mandatory crimes where you use a gun, straw purchases. We have task forces now, and I would expand those task forces where you are getting at the people who are legally acquiring guns and then illegally dishing them off to criminals. And I think you have to overlay that with the drug situation. And now a terrorism situation, homegrown, which is a brand new problem that we need to look mm-hmm. at. And that's the other half of who I am in terms of my work around the world on the terrorism issue. And who better to be the Attorney General when we're dealing with this issue on our streets in America?
I do want to pick up on that, but we've got some folks that want to join the conversation. Let me get Doug from Westchester to join us. Hi, Doug. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
Just wanted to know if the Attorney General's office can have any impact on gerrymandering, and if not, who can?
Well, that's the job of the legislature. Is every 10 years, when there's a new census, it's the legislature that makes those decisions. But I don't know. Is that something you'd want to take on, Joe Peters?
Well, it's sort of outside of the wheelhouse of the AG, but a very good question. And I think people are growing more and more frustrated. When you look at some of the nonsensical lines that are drawn, it is clear that whichever side is in power, they're doing it to ensure incumbencies, which kind of embeds people, which exacerbates the situation, and it goes from there. So I think the majority of Pennsylvanians would be for some redo of this whole process of gerrymandering so that it is a more fair, representative form of government and not a political tool.
You have worked for Republicans and Democrats. Why are you a Republican?
My dad was a Republican mayor in a 3-1 Democratic city of Scranton. And I was a Republican because he was. He started as a Democrat, actually. Okay. And he became a Republican only because a Republican mayor had asked him to serve. My dad was a young engineer as the director of public works. So in deference to the Republican mayor, he changed. But interesting, my dad, I'll never forget two lessons that he taught me as a Republican in a 3-1 Democratic city. I would say to him, Dad, you in the election, and he won resoundingly, twice. I said, you know, all these people that didn't vote for you, and now you have more Democrats in your cabinet than Republicans, and you're a Republican mayor. Hmm. And he said to me, Joey, I am mayor of all of the people, not just the ones that voted for me. The other thing he said to me in terms of R&D, he had five Democratic members of council. And if my father said, it is sunny out, the Democratic council would pass a resolution that it was cloudy. And I said, how do you not get frustrated, Dad? He said, Joe, it makes me a better mayor every day because I have to work that much harder. So that's why I'm a Republican.
But is there a Republican way of being an attorney general?
No. There can't be. There has to be an attorney general way of being an attorney general. And I think that's why my candidacy has such resonance and appeal, because I have worked for two very different presidents. Bill Clinton and George Bush could not be more different. I've worked for Kathleen Kane and all of her Republican predecessors. It is obvious that I am asked to do the jobs I do because of my ability. God, at least I hope, certainly not because of my politics. And I think that's what an attorney general should be.
You had mentioned terrorism.
Yes.
And named a couple of people in Pennsylvania that have been accused of terrorist acts. Do you see terrorism the way you see organized crime? I mean, are there some parallels there in terms of how law enforcement, even an attorney general, might approach how to deal with the problem of terrorism?
I've spent the last half of my career on this issue, including being in Israel and working with the Israeli National Police and Israeli Defense Forces on an issue that, unfortunately, the state of Israel has had to deal with so onerously for so long. You can't sit in a car next to a bus at a street corner without being in fear that the bus is going to blow up. It's a different way of life that we are now starting to know. And there are lessons there. And when you see 70,000 Israelis volunteer, citizens, moms, dads, stockbrokers, whatever, volunteer in the evening to direct traffic, to fix tires on the vehicles, to do whatever. You know, a community that embraces its issue, which is what we need to do with this terrorism issue, is not unlike, I remember marching in the Mantua area of Philadelphia with Herman Rice. I don't know if any will remember.
No, I remember Herman Rice.
His white
very well.
Construction hat, and he took back his neighborhood. And one of the things that, you know, I worked in two White Houses and people say, oh, it must be great and all the great innovations. Uh-uh. There are no geniuses inside the Beltway. The White House and the government can be a facilitator for the solutions, the real ones that come from the community up. When people own a problem and embrace it, they solve it.
You want to deputize people to take on terrorism?
No, I want to have people be alert. See something, say something. Sounds a little cliche. It's kind of Nancy Reagan-esque, God rest her soul, that, you know, don't use drugs and that sort of thing. But this is a community problem now. This is unlike any other problem. All the other crimes are based on money and greed and power. This is a crime based on ideology. How do you deal with that? These are people who are blowing themselves up with a few bucks worth of implements, thinking that they are martyrs, having hijacked a religion that is beautiful, and now we're having Muslims being besmirched because they're Muslims, which is just as unfair as any other crime. And this is a real problem for us. And part of the solution is, as we did in Ohio, where the U.S. attorney brought in someone who had radicalized people in the Middle East, was a terrorist, short of pulling a trigger or initiating a bomb, and talked about what he did and worked with the elders in the Islamic community. In that case, it was a second-generation Somalian community, so that their own community could help prevent radicalization. Because this weapon, and help them identify it and stop it, stop its progression. You know, what is this? This is a young kid down the street. This is the same kid, Marty, in my mind, that was joining a gang 40 years ago, a street gang. Kind of destitute, no focus, no hope, who in his basement now is looking at the computer and seeing all these guns and cars and flags, and it's glamorous and glorious, and he or she could be a part of something. So they want to be this, and they go over to Europe in the summer. It looks like a kid on vacation going from Philly to Spain. But then they go into Turkey, cross into Syria, train up, fight up, come home, and they're a hidden missile waiting to strike.
You had mentioned, though, earlier, the I believe it was a state state trooper who was shot by not anyone that identified themselves with ISIS or any of these extreme forms of Islam, but had his own particular ideology.
Yes.
And
though not ISIS inspired or aspirational toward jihad, he was in a very different way a homegrown violent extremist. His was predicated, it seems, on an anti-government perspective. But it translates to killing cops. We can't have it.
Let me get Jack from, looks like South Jersey, to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Jack. Go ahead. You're on the air.
My question is for Joe, and it's about the heroin epidemic. I've been living that nightmare for like 15 years with my three adult children.
I'm sorry to hear that.
And I've been to many, many funerals of friends' children. And I have two questions. Number one is, I hear the treatment thing, and I totally agree with that, but I don't hear anything about stopping it at its source. And I have questioned several mayors in small communities around where I live, where a lot of people are dying from the heroin. And they tell me they feel that the government's involved, that there's too much money, and they think that the reason it's not going away is because the government's involved.
Hmm.
I want to know why we're not stopping at the source, number one.
Well, you know what, Jack? Only because we're almost out of time here, and you raise an important question, which is, yes, you can focus on the person using the heroin, but how do you get to the person who's been supplying it? Joe?
Jack, excellent question, and my condolences on your loss and your suffering. And you embody and the problem we're talking about. It affects everybody. The Attorney General, first off, is the chief law enforcement officer. I first am a cop, a chief, and a prosecutor. That's what I am, who I know. It's been my whole career, and I've worked on the issue globally. We have to get better in using and linking this problem, including at its source, as Jack points out, you know, the poppy cultivation, who's growing it, whatever the drug, whatever the genesis. How can we use diplomatic and other means in addition to coalescing law enforcement? I'm supposed to be in London 3 days before the election because I sit on the terrorism committee of the IACP, the International Association of Chiefs of Police, and meeting at MI5, you know, London's famed agency, on these two issues and the linkage between them, because, you know, drugs is money and money drives terrorism, and drugs are involved in governments, and whether it's Afghanistan or Pakistan or Burma or all those, you know, so everything is intertwined, and we need somebody who knows his or her stuff from bottom to top to be able to deal with it in a frontal way in Pennsylvania.
Jack, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. I mentioned that there is a presidential race going on. Is there a particular candidate that you support running for the White House?
No. I am so busy running for my office and to be the Attorney General of Pennsylvania that it is difficult to focus. And, you know, who am I to be suggesting to other people? So I'll talk about Joe Peters and joepeters.com, which is my new name, by the way.
And
the issues with this office rather than be sort of talking about other races.
You were a theater minor.
I was.
Does that help running for office to have a theater background?
Well, you've got to be entertaining. And you've got to be gregarious, and I don't know. That training has helped me probably in the courtroom. I just have a love of the theater. It's kind of antithetical to who I am. I mean, even my sister's like, you know, you're this like mafia buster fighting terrorists, and yet you love the theater and you like your tomato plants in the garden. You know, who are you? So,
a very good question.
Yeah, and yet to be answered, I guess.
Well, Joe Peters, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And again, he's running against State Senator John Rafferty for the Republican nomination for Attorney General. There is a primary April 26th here in Pennsylvania. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, sign up for the newsletter, listen to us on satellite radio. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.